me say here that in my own case, it's been my fate to look at many of the horrors of the last half of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. I confess to a commitment to confront these collective horrors, but I do so in a spirit of hope, seeking small currents of understanding that may help us to take more humane directions. The principle is a very simple one. It's that of looking into the abyss in order to see beyond it. If you don't look into the abyss, you're not seeing where we are. And if you stay stuck in the abyss, you're immobilized and can't do very much about it. The immediate abyss for us now is the war in Iraq, and also the mindset of those who created that war. And we need to confront those if we're to take stock of where we are. Very simple point to start with, which is probably clear to you already. The war in Iraq is a war of choice. We didn't have to go to war. It was a war that those who created it, in the case of those who created it, who felt motivated to initiate it, it was described as a preemptive war. It hasn't even been that. A preemptive war can be said to exist when the alleged enemy has initiated or is initiating or is about to initiate an attack on you. There was no such situation in Iraq. It was a preventive war, and preventive war with the idea that somehow, in some way, this country, this regime, is dangerous to one's own future. A preventive war policy becomes particularly grotesque in the nuclear age. Some of you in this audience may be old enough to remember the cries for preventive war when the Soviet Union began to develop nuclear weapons. The thought was, well, we better annihilate them now before they use these weapons on us. Had we listened to these voices for a preventive war, tens of millions of people would have been incinerated. Fortunately, other views prevailed. I'll be talking about what I call a worldwide epidemic of apocalyptic violence aimed at vast destruction in the service of some kind of purification and renewal. I'll say more about that in a while. But I want to just say a little bit about my approach over the years to these kinds of issues. And it's been, broadly speaking, psychohistorical. That really means no more than applying psychological methods to historical questions. And in that work, I've been much influenced by Erik Erikson, who developed a model or paradigm of the great man or the great person in history. And his two subjects of psychobiography were Gandhi and Luther, and his model was that of the great man or great person struggling with inner conflicts which can be solved not only for himself but for a whole collectivity of his time and era. And that's what he did in the case of Gandhi and Luther. My own journey through these events in the 20th and 21st centuries has to do with efforts at what could be called professional witness to these events. But I want to say that when we look at 9/11 and post-9/11 behavior today, it's a little different from what I've studied. Different in the sense that it's still very much with us. We are in it. We're in it because 9/11 is so recent, and all the more so because our leaders have systematically manipulated it in terms of manipulating fear and taking advantage of various responses to 9/11 for their own political and military purposes. In any case, we're still very much immersed in it now. In terms of some of the studies that I've done, and I'm only mentioning these as they have bearing on our present situation, let me mention four of them. Way back in the mid-50s, my earliest study was that of Chinese communist thought reform, a so-called brainwashing, and I was focusing at that time on the phenomenon of ideological totalism, all or none immersion in a movement and ideas. And everything I've done since then has some connection to that issue of ideological totalism. But I came to realize subsequently that this psychological or mental process had its own apocalyptic dimensions. It really was an effort to remove and destroy all pre-revolutionary thought in order to replace it with the ultimate revolutionary truth. It was a quest for ownership of the mind, ownership of truth, ownership of reality, so much so that the Chinese over-reformed. The Chinese communists came in as heroes. They had won a revolution, a heroic long march, and they were looked upon with enormous respect by much of the population when they arrived, but they had a religious-like impulse to reform and couldn't stop reforming in various ways. And for that and many other reasons involving corruption, changed from one of the most powerfully supported regimes to one of the most corrupt on the globe. In any case, what I learned from studying Chinese communist thought reform, I knew wasn't limited to them. And I tried to apply it to my own country, beginning with its application to the McCarthyism of the 1950s and the efforts to control political life and false accusations and many parallels that I found with Chinese communist thought reform. But one can look no further than the reality reversals of the Bush administration at the present, really looking at Iraq to start with and to finish with, in terms of reversing reality when things are absolute chaos, as they are now, being presented as a success story in the democratization of the country. And similar things are done with domestic issues, such as Medicare, jobs, benefits, and other issues of that kind. This kind of reversal of reality is more than just control of spin. It's, again, an effort at ownership of the mind or of reality control.